Imagine a closed office door at around 5:30 AG PM
Okay.
to a male manager who's pulling a colleague in to just, review a project. It probably means one very simple thing. Let's focus. Let's get this done before we head home.
Right, just avoiding distractions.
Exactly. But to a female employee walking into that exact same room, that closed door might trigger this immediate invisible risk assessment.
Yeah.
She is suddenly hyper aware of the hour, the empty hallway outside, and the power dynamic in the room. And so today we're really looking at this massive gap between what men intend in everyday situations and what women actually experience.
It really forces a complete reevaluation of those situations that we normally just label as neutral, you know? I mean, stepping into a space that requires putting aside instinctual defensiveness so we can understand a completely different lived reality.
And I want to explicitly set a very serious, very grounded tone for this deep dive right from the start.
Yeah, absolutely necessary.
Our mission today for you, the listener, is to explore a profound shift in perspective. Specifically, we're looking at how men can transition from being passive observers to active participants in reducing harm and preventing violence against women.
It's a heavy topic, but so critical.
It really is. And to do this, we are unpacking a really comprehensive 61-lesson training course. It's from an organization called HACESL, and it's titled, How Can I Do More as a Man?
And, you know, if you're listening to this right now and feeling maybe a little bit defensive, perhaps, like, but I've never done anything like that, I'm a good guy. The course actually anticipates that exact
It
reaction.
really does,
It
yeah.
brings up this really crucial framing question, which is, what happens when we realize that simply being a good guy is actually insufficient to change the culture around us?
And that right there is the foundational concept of the entire text. Doing
Yeah.
no harm is not the same thing as reducing harm. I mean, this material is not about blaming men. It doesn't assume bad intent. And it definitely isn't demanding perfection. It is entirely about recognizing your influence.
Because influence is always there, whether you use it actively or not.
Exactly. So think about the traditional concept of safety. We so often picture a physical presence, right? Like a bodyguard, someone who is there to just step in when a threat appears.
Yeah, but that bodyguard model assumes that the harm is already inevitable, right? It places a man in this purely reactive role, just kind of waiting for some overt danger to show up so he can intervene and shield someone.
Right, and the course highlights this incredibly crucial difference between protecting and preventing, because prevention changes the environmental conditions completely.
It's a totally different approach.
It is. The ultimate role of prevention is to create a society where safety does not rely on a male presence at all. And to change those broader environmental conditions, the text insists we have to start by looking at the most intimate environments.
Like our homes and friend groups.
Yeah, our close relationships and our private social circles.
Which makes sense because historically, the expectation has been placed really heavily on women to just educate the men in their lives about safety and, their lived experiences.
And it is an exhausting dynamic.
Right, completely exhausting. So the curriculum challenges men to shift that burden by proactively educating themselves. Before they even enter conversations that require that kind of care.
And one of the most striking concepts in the material regarding this is the idea of the preview.
Oh, yeah, this part was fascinating.
It really is. Think of it like a movie trailer that tells you exactly what genre of film you're about to watch. So how men speak about things that don't directly involve them acts as a preview for the women in their lives.
So, like, if they're just chatting about the news.
Right. Imagine a couple watching the news and a story about a celebrity assault case comes on. If a man casually expresses doubt or he, minimizes the accusation or questions the victim's motives, he is quietly broadcasting a really clear message.
He's showing his cards.
Exactly. He is telling the women around him, you will need airtight proof to be believed, or your experience is up for debate.
And the psychological impact of that is just immense because trust is either being built or eroded in those really casual, everyday reactions.
Right.
A woman files that preview away. You know, it completely dictates whether she will ever feel safe disclosing her own experiences to him in the future.
Which brings up a very real, very difficult friction point regarding disclosures. When a woman does share a difficult experience with a man she trusts, the deeply ingrained male instinct is so often to react with, immediate anger at the perpetrator.
Yeah, or to just jump straight into problem-solving mode, right? Like, let's fix this.
Exactly. And I really want to push back on that instinct. I mean, I understand why it happens. It comes from a desire to protect. But the text breaks down exactly why this response is actually counterproductive.
Because it centers the man's emotional experience rather than the woman's, right?
Yes, exactly.
The psychology behind that anger is often rooted in a feeling of powerlessness. The man just wants to regain control of the situation by fixing it or, you know, lashing out.
And the result of that is that the entire focus shifts completely away from the person who is actually harmed.
Right.
Suddenly, she feels responsible for managing the man's emotions. She has to calm him down, which can severely increase her fear about ever sharing things in the future.
So what should that reaction actually look like?
Well, being a true safe space sounds very different. It sounds like asking, what would feel most helpful right now? Or, you know, do you want to talk? Or would you rather take some time?
That takes a lot of restraint.
It really does. It requires immense emotional regulation to just sit with that discomfort and not make it about your own need to act.
And I think that emotional regulation is equally critical when we look at how men behave with other men.
Oh, completely.
Because if a man is doing this internal work individually, the true test is really what happens when he enters a space where the group dynamic often penalizes vulnerability, you know, like the classic locker room or the group chat environment.
Yeah, and the course is absolutely unflinching on this subject. It says jokes are never just jokes.
Right.
In a private group chat or, you know, at a pub, a joke is a tool used to test boundaries. We have to look at the psychology of why men use humor this way. It establishes a social hierarchy.
It normalizes the misogyny while keeping this total plausible deniability.
Exactly. Because if anyone objects, their discomfort is immediately weaponized against them. They're just reframed as being oversensitive or lacking a sense of humor.
It really creates this microculture where empathy is perceived as a weakness. And in those group dynamics, silence basically functions as agreement.
Yes, silence is complicity.
Right. A comment that goes unchallenged just signals to the entire group that this behavior is the accepted baseline.
But the text offers a really practical approach to dismantling this. Calling out your friends does not require hostility, and it rarely works if it involves public shaming. That just triggers more defensiveness.
So it's better to do it privately.
Yeah, it's about addressing the impact over the intent, usually in a private one-on-one conversation. Just saying, hey, that comment yesterday didn't really sit right with me, strips away the audience, and it forces a genuine reflection on the behavior itself.
And those private spaces are basically the incubators for broader societal norms, mm-hmm. right? The behavior that gets tolerated in a weekend group chat inevitably informs how those exact same men operate in professional environments on Monday morning.
Which brings us to the workplace, where these informal power structures really dictate safety on a daily basis.
Yeah, the transition from private to professional is pretty seamless.
It is. And workplace inequality rarely starts with extreme HR reportable behavior. It manifests in very subtle structural ways. It starts with who gets heard. Across industries, the data shows women are significantly more likely to be interrupted, spoken over, credited less for their ideas, or subtly expected to take notes and manage the emotional temperature of the room.
It's this invisible architecture of exclusion.
That's a great way to put it.
So a man using his informal power to interrupt that pattern by saying, you know, I don't think she was finished with her point. That is an actual structural intervention.
And the text is super clear that redirecting attention back to an interrupted colleague is not giving her special treatment. It's actively correcting an existing imbalance.
Right.
But I have to admit, looking at the section on invisible risk, I realized how much of an automatic reflex it is for me as a woman. You know, we mentioned that closed door at 5:30 p.m. earlier.
Yeah.
A male colleague closes his door to focus, and my brain instantly does a threat assessment. So if I put myself in the shoes of a male manager reading this, how do I navigate that? How do men operate without feeling completely paralyzed by overthinking every single interaction?
Well, according to the text, it isn't about walking on eggshells or living in a constant state of paralysis. Mm. It's about developing situational awareness.
Okay.
The goal is simply to recognize that perfectly ordinary decisions carry a completely different weight depending on who is in the room.
And the course lists very specific scenarios where this awareness needs to be applied, right? Like working late in an empty office, traveling for conferences, attending networking events with alcohol, or really any situation where a woman is the only female in a male-dominated setting.
Exactly. What feels like a completely neutral professional requirement to a man can feel pressured, isolating, or even physically unsafe to a female colleague.
Which really demands a shift in how leadership approaches workplace culture. It can't just rely on individuals policing every single micro interaction. Managers have to actively monitor the environment.
Yeah, so how does leadership actually step up here?
The directive is that leaders must act on patterns, not just single complaints. If a manager only reacts to extreme incidents, but ignores low-level repetitive boundary crossing, like, say, a male employee who constantly stands just a little too close or makes inappropriate jokes, they are failing their team.
They're letting the culture degrade.
Exactly. Furthermore, leaders have to actively protect those who speak up from professional backlash, because silence from leadership does not communicate neutrality. Silence communicates acceptance.
That's a really powerful point.
Yeah, culture isn't what's written in an employee handbook. Culture is the worst behavior that leadership is willing to tolerate.
And if we follow that thread, that the environments we tolerate dictate the safety of the people within them, we naturally arrive at the systemic level. Because the ultimate goal of harm reduction is systemic change. And that means looking at how we shape the next generation.
Yes, parenting is a massive component of this curriculum.
I was really interested in this section.
It's vital. The course contrasts the traditional ways children are raised and the really subtle, often damaging messages they absorb. For boys, the text emphasizes an urgent need to challenge the boys will be boys narrative.
Right, dismantling that excuse early on.
Exactly. This requires teaching boys from a very young age that attraction does not create obligation. They need to learn that rejection is just a normal, survivable part of life, not an insult to their masculinity.
It's about equipping young boys with emotional literacy so they don't just default to anger when their ego gets bruised. But, the challenge for parents today is really the pipeline of digital influence. We're looking at algorithmic radicalization.
Yeah, let's break down how that pipeline actually works, because it is incredibly insidious.
There he is.
A teenage boy goes on YouTube or TikTok, right? And he's just looking for workout advice or fitness routines. The algorithm recognizes his engagement and begins feeding him content about discipline and masculinity.
And then it shifts.
Right. Gradually, the videos shift from physical fitness to an alpha mindset. And before long, the content is actively teaching him that women are either obstacles to his success or objects for his consumption.
Yeah, online misogyny is routinely packaged and sold as self-improvement.
Exactly. And banning devices rarely works because the ideology permeates their social groups at school anyway.
So what's the intervention then?
The intervention requires teaching aggressive critical thinking. The course suggests early intervention based on calm curiosity rather than punishment.
Like asking questions instead of assuming bad intent.
Yes. What made you think that? Or let's unpack where that creator is actually getting his information. Parents have to give boys the active tools to dismantle the narratives they're being fed online.
And what about the traditional messaging given to girls? How does the text address the kind of safety advice parents usually pass down to their daughters?
Oh, the text pushes back hard on the well-meaning advice parents have given girls for generations.
Things like, don't walk alone in the dark.
Right. Don't walk alone. Hold your keys between your fingers. Or, be careful what you wear. The psychological impact of this advice is that it quietly teaches girls that their safety depends entirely on their compliance.
Whoa.
It teaches them that it is their responsibility to manage the predatory behavior of others. So the course argues that girls must instead be taught autonomy.
They need to know they're allowed to take up space.
Exactly. They need to be taught how to set boundaries without fear of being labeled impolite, and they need to know they are allowed to take up space in the world.
And that concept of taking up space connects directly to how adults navigate public areas,
yeah.
Right? The curriculum addresses a very common point of friction for men, which is encountering women in public who appear distant, give short responses, or outright decline small talk.
Yes, women are so often perceived as unfriendly in public spaces. But the text provides a really vital reminder here. A woman's short response or distant demeanor is a real-time risk assessment.
She's just trying to stay safe.
Exactly. She is scanning for exits, evaluating the man's body language, and calculating the safest way to disengage. It's purely an act of self-protection. It has absolutely nothing to do with the man's character.
Because even if a man's intentions are entirely pure, a woman commuting or sitting alone does not have access to his internal monologue.
Right.
She only has access to the statistics of what happens to women in public.
Which is why respecting those boundaries without taking offense is so crucial. If a woman gives a short answer, the instinct for some men is to feel insulted or to try and prove they're one of the good ones.
Which just centers their ego again.
Exactly. The course asks men to prioritize her physical feeling of safety over their own ego in that exact moment. Letting the interaction go is a tangible way to reduce the ambient pressure women face daily.
And beyond these individual interactions, the text outlines structural society-level actions that are required for real change.
Yes. The course explicitly urges men to use their voting power to examine structural priorities. Now, reporting impartially on what the text says here, it asks voters to look objectively at which political platforms meaningfully address violence against women and which policies structurally prioritize women's safety, health care, and equal rights.
Right. It's an exercise in evaluating whether a society treats women as a priority or an afterthought.
Exactly. It also demands a critical eye toward the media. The text points out how frequently news narratives rely on victim blaming.
We see it constantly.
All the time. Headlines will focus heavily on what a woman was wearing, how much she had to drink, or why she was walking alone at night.
Which subtly shifts the burden of responsibility away from the perpetrator's actions.
Yes, and the course calls on men to actively question and push back against that framing whenever they see it.
To help individuals actually implement all of this, from challenging a media headline to intervening in an interrupted meeting, the HSSL organization utilizes a specific psychological framework. They call it default to disrupt.
Yeah, let's explain the mechanics of that framework because it's so practical.
Yeah.
Human beings naturally have a default response in uncomfortable situations, which is usually to freeze, look away, or just avoid conflict.
Right, it's a biological survival mechanism.
Yes. And the HSSL training focuses on recognizing that normal human response so we can consciously override it. By removing the shame of having a passive default reaction, it actually frees up your cognitive energy to deliberately choose a disrupt action.
So it forces you to pause, look at the situation, and choose a realistic alternative that interrupts the harm.
Exactly.
Which is precisely why an organization focused on harm reduction targets men with this specific curriculum. It's not because men are inherently more capable of doing the work of equality.
No, not at all. It is because when men engage in these spaces, they carry a specific type of social currency among other men. When a man speaks up, it dramatically reduces the defensiveness of the men around him. It shifts the baseline of what is taken seriously. If a male executive advocates for this training at work, it instantly moves the conversation from being perceived as a niche emotional concern to a mandatory structural priority.
He leverages his informal influence to create systemic change.
Yes.
And that systemic change is rarely the result of one massive heroic gesture. It's the everyday accumulation of tiny conscious choices.
The text reminds us that progress happens through small, consistent actions over time. Sharing resources, taking further education seriously, choosing to have an awkward conversation with a friend, or advocating for better policies at your workplace.
It's the shift from the bodyguard mentality to the architect mentality.
Yeah.
You're no longer waiting for a threat. You're redesigning the environment.
That's a perfect way to phrase it. And as we wrap up our analysis of this material, there's a really profound final thought from the text to mull over.
Yeah.
The course emphasizes that trust isn't a declaration. You cannot simply announce to the world or to the women in your life that you are a safe person. Trust is a slow, methodical build. It is forged entirely by your reactions in uncomfortable moments.
It's built in the friction points.
Yes. So as you go about your next 24 hours, pay attention to those friction points. When an opportunity arises to either center your own comfort or choose to interrupt a harmful pattern, whether it's a joke in a group chat, an interrupted colleague in a meeting, or just a casual comment about a news story, which will you choose? Because the people around you are always watching. They are calculating their safety based on your reactions, and they are learning from your silence just as much as your words.